Hello, everyone, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Tim Phillips.
He's gracing us with his presence. he's come.
I'm out of the weeds again, or where was I before? Deep State.
Yeah, the Deep State got you, but you know you're now a big shot on the Toronto indie theater scene. So
just a matter of time. Yeah, our play, The Joy of Sax, this summer, Theater Pass Marais Main Space. So we've got a venue now, and got our dates in July, so if you happen to be in Toronto, come check it out.
Save the plugs for the end of the show.
No, I like to do it at the start, in case people don't listen all the way through.
Well, you should listen all the way through. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and we are here every Wednesday. This week at 3 p.m. because we had to take an hour back because of the debate. Usually we're at 2 p.m., but at 3 p.m. this week to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new coming-of-age indie drama Lean on Pete. That is in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the recent news items from the past week, including Rambo 5. They just announced the next sequel. Well, Rambo's going to go down to Mexico and show them who's boss. But we're going to talk about another direction they could have taken Rambo in. And then we're going to talk about Bill and Ted coming back as middle-aged suburban dads in another time travel comedy. And we're going to talk about whether it's really worthwhile to dig up all these old franchises. I can only imagine where I'm going to end up on that issue, given what I just said. But first, another project that's been long in the works for a really, really, really long time is The Man Who Killed Don Quixote. It is... I think it's, if you spent 20 years on something, it's probably your passion project.
Yeah.
So that's director Terry Gilliam's passion project. And it was about to make its bow at Cannes later this month. And then bam, lawsuit from an old producer. I wanted to talk about this because it's funny to think of the movie industry now, and we talk about this a lot on the show. It's like this machine where, you know, Marvel, Star Wars, Disney, mm-hmm. Warner Brothers, all cranking out these huge franchises. And here we have an example of a film where everything that can go wrong has gone wrong and is still going wrong for two decades, spanning two decades.
Yeah.
And, you know, it really makes you... you know, you a filmmaker yourself. It makes you appreciate the process, I think, that, you know, 20 years later.
Well, there's so much collaboration. And then when you get producers involved, and over 20 years, you think of all the different casts he had probably in his mind, or he mm-hmm. cast people for the movie. It just, there's so many things that can go wrong and probably have for him. And it's unfortunate because it seems to be a big passion for him, but it's... At least he's stuck with it. I'll give him that.
Yeah.
And he's had controversy too, right? Some of his comments regarding Harvey Weinstein a couple months ago.
Yeah, he's not helped himself in that regard.
No.
And this was kind of like an under the wire thing. I don't think it was part of the original announced lineup. It was it's going to be closing night. So the controversy is, because it's been going on for 20 years, there was a producer on board for most of that time. His claim expired, I think, in August 2016, and at that point, shortly thereafter, Amazon came on, and then ponied up the money to actually make it, and production started in March 2017, and the producer is claiming that he is owed some kind of back pay for the previous 18 years of production. So he was asking for an injunction, and this is not actually an unusual thing that happened. I remember there was a movie at TIFF a couple of years ago that was supposed to screen and then couldn't screen because of a situation very much like this, where a producer says, wait, hold on, I did a lot of this work up front and I'm not getting my due, I'm not getting my credit, so if this thing sells, you know, I'm not going to get my cut. And did I say that was London Fields? That was what that movie was called?
No.
Okay.
Didn't.
Yeah. It was called London Fields. I think it stars Amber Heard and Billy Bob Thornton.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, you know, this is want to happen sometimes in the world of indie cinema, where you're putting together financing piecemeal. And
yeah, I don't know the details, but it sounds like the producer is being pretty petty, though, right? Because he could always win the lawsuit after the fact. If the movie's successful, he would recoup money, I'm sure, if he had his day in court and he was successful. So to not have it screen and try to block it from screening strikes me as he has something against Terry Gilliam, or he's,
yeah,
you know, and Terry Gilliam isn't the most liked person, so he may have rubbed this, and especially he's so focused on getting a movie made. It's like his mission is, it's like his arc or something he's making each time he makes a movie. So he probably ruffles feathers, fires people, has arguments, and for the producer to do that, like, the upside for him would be if it was successful, he won a lawsuit and he made money off of it, I would think. So to, like, just block it, right, and say it shouldn't go into existence, I think there might be some personal issues behind that as well.
You make a good point, because you think his maybe standing would be better if it, what did come out, it wasn't a success, and then you have the financiers, because I think Amazon was supposed to distribute it until this came out, and presently they're not going to be distributing it, although there is distribution in, I think, France and China, interestingly enough. But Amazon has, maybe they, you know, now that the legal stuff has been cleared up, maybe they'll step up again. But yeah, you would think that if it would come out and successful and money is made, then maybe a more generous studio or distributor, you know, with that influx of cash, might feel, okay, well, we'll write him a check and that's fine. We'll just take that hitch because price of doing business, so on and so forth. Of course, this is a Terry Gilliam movie. He's not exactly, you know, these movies don't exactly open with $100 million at the box office.
And you wonder what took so long with the 20 years. Like, I'm sure
it was chronicled in a documentary called Lost, which is the flip side of this, because this thing's almost made money just by the urban legend kind of feel of it, and because there was the documentary Lost in La Mancha was made by these guys, Keith Fullen and Louis Pepe,
right,
who are also actually releasing another documentary, which is about the finished production. I can't remember what it's called, although I did write it down, which I should never do because I can never read my writing when I'm trying. He Dreamed of Giants is what it was called. So if I filibuster long enough, I can read my own writing. I think it's their third documentary about Terry Gilliam trying to make this project. So there is somebody's making money at least. Which, you know, maybe why the producer maybe feels emboldened, you know, you very well could be right. It'd just be a matter of, you know, he is mad at Gilliam and doesn't want to, after investing so much, doesn't want to see him succeed. But, you know, for the sake of Terry Gilliam, I kind of want to, you know, you put 20 years of effort into something. There was, it was the Lost in La Mancha movie. Follows the first time they tried to start. It was starred Johnny Depp and the French actor. His name's Jean Rochefort, who actually got ill and couldn't continue on in the role of Don Quixote. And then they couldn't get insured for the project, and then there were like floods that like destroyed equipment and things.
Right.
And now the movie, the completed movie, which hopefully everyone will get to see, stars Adam Driver in what would have been the Depp role, and Jonathan Pryce is Don Quixote.
Right, yeah.
So.
Yeah, well, that it shows like Terry Gilliam's into film for art. What he, you know, like that's, you know, he probably doesn't care how much the box office is.
Oh,
he's
no.
got such a deep emotional attachment to his projects, right? So just for him, yeah, it'd be nice if it could be released after all that effort and work he put into it.
And I mean, he's also someone who I don't know if he thrives on these adversities, but one of his recent ones, well, it's almost 10 years ago now, but The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, which starred Heath Ledger, and then he died. Heath Ledger died halfway through, or maybe not even halfway, but partial way through it. And then the Heath Ledger part is played in these like dream sequences by, I want to say Johnny Depp, Colin Firth, not Colin Firth, Colin Farrell, and I can't remember the other actor, but you know, so he knows how to persevere and he knows how to like alter his vision to respond to these things. And, you know, long story short is that this will be able to, the injunction failed and it will be screening at the end of Con. And that's then at which I think at that point, we'll probably see where it goes from here, whether, you know, it might be one of those things where Con audience is notorious for, you know, making their feelings known.
They might boo it or give it a standing 20-minute standing ovation. Crazy there. And Con's had controversy too, right? Because they haven't really been keeping up with the times. With
the whole Netflix thing.
So this might be another instance of them. But what I like, though, is that they're sticking by an artist, right?
Because,
like, the producers, they're helpful. They get the financing. They get stuff done. At the end of the day, it has to be somebody's vision or else we just end up with these cookie-cutter films. So to, like, really support an artist and get his vision, his or her vision out there, I think that's pretty cool. But it might be becoming old school in a way now, right? The way, you know, the way they're battling Netflix and, you know.
See Vince's rant last week for more on cookie cutter films. And he was not happy we were talking about Marvel Studios.
Oh, he did. Just all the tie-ins and,
bless him. Anyway. Speaking of franchises, Rambo 5 is ramping up. Sylvester Stallone, although he once said he might not come back for Rambo. He's getting too old for Rambo.
No, he'll always come back for Rambo, Rocky.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Where there's a paycheck, he'll be there.
Where there's a paycheck, he'll be there. That's right. That'll be on. Well, you know, remember the real estate thing in Toronto a couple of months ago? Where he was there.
Oh, yeah. He was.
And then he talked about real estate for like 10 minutes and then spent an hour and a half talking about Rocky.
Oh, did he?
Rambo movies.
Oh, wow. Is that on YouTube?
That's a good question. I wonder if it is. But
check that out.
I just remember somebody was like live tweeting it. But so he will do anything for money, even go to real estate expos where he will not talk about real estate because he has zero expertise on real estate.
Yeah.
But moving on to Rambo, he is coming back as Rambo. It's going to be the new Rambo movie is going to come out next year. It's going to be another he's going to be fighting Mexicans, but or Mexican, not no general population Mexicans, but members of a drug cartel and human traffickers, you know, run-of-the-mill bad guys.
Yeah.
But there was once a time they were going to make Rambo 5 The Savage Hunt, where Rambo was basically going to fight something that sounds a lot like Predator. It was like an inhuman monster, like some sort of genetic anomaly.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of torn about this because I wouldn't mind seeing that. but at the same time, I rewatched First Blood recently, and it is, you know, it's not a macho, although, you know, there's obviously a lot of influence in the way action movies were made in the 80s. It wasn't made with this kind of tone of like macho action of, you know, watch me kill this guy with breakneck speed, literally, that kind of thing. You know, there's more to it than that. There's a bit more depth to it than that. You know, I wonder if we misunderstand, you know, this particular character by not just, you know, constantly throwing him into situations where he has to, like, murder people by the dozens, but also by suggesting, like, we've done all we can with Rambo, now it's time to bring in the monsters. Yeah.
I think people may misunderstand Sylvester Stallone.
Maybe.
Because the way he talks, the way he looks, you know, it's, I was reading the article about Rambo 5, and I'm just struck by, like, how highly literate Sylvester Stallone is, and he was a screenwriter. That's how he got his start with Rocky.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't surprise me that there may be some depth you wouldn't expect in characters that he creates. And he kind of just he probably knows the limitations of like what he sounds like and what people's perception is of him. And he's got these two great characters who have, you know, made him lots of money over the years, Rambo and Rocky, and he knows he can go back to those, and people don't see him as, like, leading romantic interest or anything, you know? So there might be other characters that he may have the intellect to play, but it's just the perception when you watch him, the audience wouldn't buy it kind of thing, right?
It's funny you should say that because, something like The Specialist, where he's supposed to be, like, a romantic, like, Sharon Stone is supposed to be, like, his romantic sort of co-lead interest, and you could sort of, in a different world, if it was a different character, you might have seen that had worked, but because it's Sylvester Stallone, you don't really buy him as, like, a... Mm-hmm. You can buy him being the, like, assassin-for-hire type, but you can't really exactly buy him being, like, the Cary Grant type to come sort of swoop in and save the woman. No. It's fairly incidental.
It just doesn't work,
But, you know, it does work when in the Rocky series with Adrian, and you know, so I mean, you can believe him as a romantic lead, not just he can't walk and chew gum at the same time, I guess is what I'm thinking of. He can't, like, be the badass and also be a romantic icon at the same time. There's a very specific needle to thread,
you know, know his lane, and he stays in there, but it looks like he was trying to branch out with the idea of the monster, and you know, he's trying to add some elements. It's not like he just keeps going back to the same place and fighting the same wars.
Yeah, like the original Bloody Disgusting article that we found this from. That's a website if you don't know. It's not a Bloody Disgusting website. It's a horror film news website, but if you're not familiar with the internet, but it's, you know, he talks a lot about, you know, about the thought process of it, and you know, how the ways the monster was going to be inhuman. It wasn't just going to be like some sort of predator thing. It sounded like it was like some sort of experiment gone wrong, like part kind of human but like part savage, and he talks about how we're going to delve into the savage nature, and it's certainly part of that is about it goes back to Rambo, that, you know, this man, because of things he saw in war, kind of whittled off the humanity, his humanity a bit at a time, where, you know, he feels utterly uncomfortable walking into a place and, you know, having a meal, but, you know, as soon as the sheriff starts hassling him and drives him into the woods and starts shooting at him, he's in his element, and because that's what he's become used to, that's what they've driven him to.
It's interesting, and it kind of from limitations can come great art too. So the fact that he's sort of limited by these characters that people accept him playing, he can find some new ground, because because you don't want to see the same Rambo over and over again, right? So it's...
Ideally not. And even the last Rambo movie, you know, it suggested that he had made some sort of peace with his violent past, and that it was like a really kind of pragmatist, like, violence happens kind of ideal, but... there was a lot going on there, although it does get like ultra violent in the end. It's, you know, he was, it did feel like he was trying to say something. He did write and direct the last Rambo movie as well.
And you tried to do that with Rocky movies too. He's like, okay, I'm not going to be fighting anymore. Well, Creed, and that's been a success, and Creed 2's coming out soon.
Which he's working on right now.
So He does well when he knows his limitations, right? But like, still, like, him being in Rambo movies is still a bit funny to me. The fact that he's going to be such a violent character, and he's probably in his mid 60s now or something, right?
I think he's in his 70s.
Is he in his 70s?
To go back to the whole monster thing, I think you might have, we may have turned my opinion around on where this goes, but at the same time, I wonder, because another thing they talked about was like doing kind of a Universal Soldier thing where he fights super soldiers or something like that. But at the same time, I wonder if this is going to end up like, when people talk about Fast and the Furious, like, the only thing they have left to do is go into space.
Right.
And it's like, yeah, let's go Fast and the Furious into space and, you know,
jump
the crashing
shark,
space.
Basically, right?
Yeah. People are going to see that and they're automatically going to go, well, this is stupid. Yeah. And I have a feeling that Rambo versus Monsters would go the exact same way.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah.
Rambo versus Frankenstein or something.
Unless Guillermo del Toro is going to direct it or something.
Oh, now I want to see it again. Yeah. Guillermo del Toro presents Rambo versus Frankenstein. Yeah. Love it.
If he was on board, I would trust it. But.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well. Okay, well, that brings us to another long-running franchise that we haven't heard from in a while. Bill and Ted Face the Music. And I don't know how you feel about this. I mean, we're kind of in the same age bracket. Mm-hmm. So you probably grew up with Bill and Ted like I did.
Yeah.
Bill and Ted was the first movie I saw in theaters, actually. Oh, really? The original Bill and Ted.
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Yeah. Right? No, yeah. That was the first big movie or big screen movie that I saw in the theater. So, you know, it means a lot to me. Mm-hmm. Still, I couldn't tell you the last time I watched Bill and Ted.
No, yeah. At the time, I think I watched them like half dozen times. But in the last 20 years, I don't think I've watched them.
No. Maybe. And it's just like, I kind of have zero. Like, when it was announced this week, they're kind of shopping it at Cannes. Back to Cannes. There's this new Bill and Ted adventure coming with Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter both coming back, and the original screenwriters too, Ed Solomon and Chris Matheson, are coming back. The Galaxy Quest director Dean Parazzo is signed up to direct. So I mean, it's mm-hmm. a solid team, mm-hmm. but like I don't know, I'm not sure I'm interested in like seeing. You know, Bill and Ted is like failures. Like they haven't changed. Like the Wild Stallions music hasn't made created a better history.
I'm actually interested. I think it's that whole nostalgia factor. They're getting me with this one because I remember those movies fondly. Maybe because I haven't watched them in a while too. Mm. But like, especially the first one, Excellent Adventure. But Bogus Journey, I remember for a sequel, was actually quite hilarious as well.
Yeah, and, it's gotten. I don't think a lot of people liked it at the time because it was kind of a departure mm-hmm. from the original. But I think a lot of it's found an audience. It's got cult classic appeal now.
Yeah. So, and that's the audience they'll be going for. And what I find it like with a lot of the nostalgia is, then people will tell their sons and daughters about it, or their nieces and nephews, would be like, oh, this is a great movie from when I was a kid, from the late 80s, early 90s. Mm-hmm. Check it out. And that's how they try to build an audience. And I think they will, and I'd be interested in seeing it. I don't know if I would go to the theater or just wait till it's on Netflix.
I mean, it's got that curiosity factor, but it's like, do I want to like leave my house and watch it?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's because Keanu Reeves is a very different character now than, mm-hmm. or maybe, I mean, I don't know, but he's the Keanu Reeves of like 89, 90, 91, 92 is not, you know, the Keanu Reeves of 2018.
The stoner teenager from back then.
Yeah. But, I mean, you can still kind of see shades of, you know, that version of Keanu Reeves in something like Speed, mm-hmm. which was his sort of introduction to like action movie stardom. Mm-hmm. But, you know, now we've got like John Wick, which is, you know, this dark thing where, you know, bearded, long hair, greasy Keanu Reeves just like hates the world, just wants to be left alone, and he'll shoot everyone to be left alone.
Yeah.
And then Alex Winter, who has carved out a pretty good niche for himself as a documentary filmmaker. He did the Dark Web documentary, mm-hmm. and he did Downloaded. So he's like got a like a real kind of like firm grasp of like some of the internet concerns and the internet issues. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure what's in it for him either. I guess aside from nostalgia and a paycheck,
I think it's an interesting premise that they're washed up middle aged men who never made it with their band or their song. So it's interesting to see, because there's a whole time travel element too, how they play with that, given the fact that they're older now and they all these dreams haven't really been fulfilled. I think it's interesting. I'd want to see it. And it makes me think of there was a car commercial for with Matthew Broderick a few years back, where it was like, oh, Ferris Bueller now is like a wage slave in an office all day. And I'm like, what a cool concept. And everyone thought it was a tease for an actual movie, but it wasn't. Right. And I thought, I would go see that. That'd be cool because it's a movie from my youth, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I could recite every line from that movie. I loved it. So to see him now, like, struggling and taking, you know, playing hooky from work would be cool. So Bill and Ted, I think, similar. It's like, okay, what are they doing now? They're probably still jamming on their guitars, still trying to make hit songs, and, you know.
It's a bit sad, though. I mean, it's the idea that, you know, you're told that your music will change history and usher in a new era of peace, and then, you know, that's the kind of thing you're working under. And I guess there's a part of that I see as appealing. I think it would have been more interesting, like, if they had been successful rock stars, or they had just, like, been, like, successful enough to, like, be, like, working musicians and make money and from their profession as musicians, and to see them sitting back going, okay, when does this happen? When does our music take off? And it could speak to, like, the dilemma of a lot of artists of not being appreciated in their own time. You know, Van Gogh can sell his paintings for enough money to buy a drink. So, you know, could you imagine, you know, Vincent van Gogh coming, you know, into, you know, 2018 and seeing one of his paintings sell for millions and millions of dollars? He'd probably have a heart attack right there. There's something a bit more interesting there than, like, seeing another movie about middle-aged white guys upset that they haven't amounted to anything, even if it is Bill and Ted.
So that isn't the premise, then, that they were recording songs and...
Well, I think the premise is that they have not, that they've sort of been working away and then have had to, I guess, you know, sell out and get jobs and have families and have not been able to take off as musicians, and but are struggling because they have been told that they will write the song. And then that's where we pick up with the movie. Of course, we're going to pick up without George Carlin as well. George Carlin's no longer with us. So he won't be coming back as Rufus. And even Bernie Casey, who played their history teacher, you know, I would have loved to have seen him come back and, like, laugh at them. And it's like, yeah, you did that great history. Where are you now? Or, I don't know. Maybe he doesn't care. But, you know, the cast is, I guess they got to hire two actresses to play their daughters, too. I think, I almost think it'd be funny if they got Harley Quinn Smith and Lily Rose Depp to play their daughters. I think, because just from their appearances in the Kevin Smith movies, the Tusk and what was the other one they were in? Yoga Hosers. I think they'd make a good, like, Bill and Ted, the Next Generation. Right. But, I mean, I'm not in charge, so who knows?
You should email them.
I should find the email for the producers of Bill and Ted.
Tweet at them. Tweet constantly.
until they're disgusted with my suggestions. Well, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back with our movie review, which is this week, Lean on Pete. And so... it's a horse movie, so I thought, why not play a little Bird City? animal related, I guess. But it's also on the CFRU Top 10. And local artist too, Bird City, you should check them out. And this is from their album Winnowing. And this is a track called Growing Two. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph, Compass, and Community Radio.
The glances I once ran from. And all the while, I'll grow and they'll grow distant. Maybe if I stay intriguing, it'll be different. Will you be mine at that time? Will you be mine? The one that never counted. The one that left behind the amount that never amounted to what I say I do. If I had me
started... So what do you like to do, Charlie? When Dell here isn't making you do all this dirty work?
I run. I play football.
at school?
Yeah, but not yet. I played in Spokane. I was on the freshman team. We won 8 games in a row.
What position?
Corner, and sometimes wide receiver. But I'm too little to play anything else. I'm waiting to lift weights until I stop growing. I haven't grown in 6 months, so maybe soon.
Why'd you move to Portland?
My dad moved here for work.
What's he do? Can we not talk? I ain't talking to you, I'm talking to the kid. I was tired of talking to you 15 minutes after I met you 20 years ago.
That's a good one.
Just tell it like I see it.
Love to kid each other there. Yeah, that was a clip from Lean on Pete. It is a new film from Andrew Haigh, and it stars Charlie Plummer, Travis Fimmel, Steve Buscemi, Chloe Sevigny, and Steve Zahn. I didn't discuss this with Tim before the show, but I do feel like this can only be best discussed with spoilers.
Okay.
So just, you know, be aware of that. I realize not everyone is spoiler sensitive, but you know, if you might even want to watch the show before hearing or watch the movie before hearing our opinions on the show, then just be advised. Mm-hmm. If not, then we will proceed. And I think the first thing I'll say is, you know, this is probably not the film for you if you love horses.
Yeah, maybe. but the boy has a great relationship with the horse. So
oh, yeah.
It's,
I just meant the fate of the horse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say actually, if you were around horses, you probably would have more of an appreciation for this movie.
Maybe.
And then also you see, as many people know, this the drugging that goes on with horses and in racetracks. I can only imagine in lower level racetracks what goes on with horses, and you see that element. With the Steve Buscemi character and Chloe Sevigny, who's a jockey in a racetrack in Portland. But you see also like their good side and you see the bad side of all these characters.
That's what I found very compelling about this movie is that, you know, any one of these people whom Charlie interacts with could be like a good adult role model if they weren't like so tragically hung up on their own devils, shall we say. You know, his father is a good guy. You know, there's nothing about his relationship with his father that says that, you know, his father's hits him or is, you know, abusive in any way. You know, they have a very good relationship from what you see. It's just the father is perhaps not doesn't have a fatherly bone in his body in terms of his own reaction. And we get kind of hints of that through the film. You know, even the character Dell, who is like presented as this, you know, kind of gruff guy, kind of shady guy who's, you know, maybe shocking his horses to run and run faster, maybe drugging his horses, giving them steroids. You know, there's a scene where he's like, we got to get out of here before, you know, when they're at one race. And, but on the other hand, you know, he's eating lunch with Charlie and he's like, you know, don't you know any manners? Like, you should learn manners. Yes. And then like, he'll give him like extra money. Like, you did a good job today.
Yeah.
And, you know, it almost makes it more, you know, all the more heartbreaking when Charlie comes to rely on these people.
Yeah.
And they end up letting him down.
Yeah. He's the real father lets him down through like his philandering ways and even though he seems to really love his son and he wants to look out for him, he really can't. Seems like sort of like a drunken, you know, womanizer basically is what he is. And then the Steve Buscemi character, Dell, is very interesting, like you say, because he gives him advice, gives him a job, and becomes sort of like a surrogate father in a way until Charlie realizes the fate of these horses and really the dark side of Dell. And then Chloe Sevigny could even be kind of like a surrogate mother because he doesn't have a real mother.
Yeah.
She gives advice and she's like, oh, these horses aren't pets.
Right.
You know, this is a business and you'll learn this as you grow up kind of thing. And
but, you know, and that's how desperate it is that Charlie is to hold on to something, anything, that people keep telling him to his face, you don't get attached to the horse because then the horse is put, you know, at the end of his life when the horse isn't useful anymore, we're going to put him on a truck to Mexico.
Right.
Mexico equals glue factory, by the way, because they, I guess they don't slaughter horses in the United States.
Right.
Or, you know, I'm...
That's what they say in the movie.
Right, that's what they say in the movie. Which has I don't know the horse trade, obviously, but I guess you can get away with anything in Mexico. But, I mean, that's the hard truth of it. But, again, this kid is so desperate to hang on to anything. And the fascinating thing to me is you see here in that clip that he moved from Spokane. So it's not like he comes from, like, a horse ranch or anything. He doesn't come from, like, an environment where he would have been exposed to horses before.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the thing I've been thinking about a lot since watching the film. It's like, well, why horses? Why does he find himself sort of attracted to this racetrack and seeing the horses? And why does he feel, like, this calling?
Mm-hmm.
Why does he get this attachment to Pete? You know, there's nothing... Like, if you grow up around horses, you know, you might have a lifelong attachment to horses. But, you know, it seems like one day he's like, I know, horses.
Yes, I think because he sees his world so small and he sees that he goes for a run. He's a runner and runs by and he sees the horse track, the local horse track.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an interesting point you bring up because they're in Portland, Oregon, and that's a pretty big city, right? But this movie seems so rural in so many aspects, or a small town, like where they're living. It seems like it could be a small town, not like a big city like Portland or, you know, Spokane. I'm not really sure how big that is. It's not a megatropolis, but it's still a city, right?
And it's a university town, so it would not be small.
Yeah, and that's where he's coming from. And it's interesting because it's kind of a shock to the system when he ends up in, like, homeless shelters and stuff that's, like, downtown in these cities.
Yeah.
Because you're finally seeing an urban environment. Because so much of the movie, and it's really beautifully shot, takes place in farmers' fields and
deserts
and stuff like that. So,
It is a really good film, good-looking film.
Mm-hmm.
It's also anchored, I think, by Charlie Plummer, who... was in All the Money in the World. He played John Getty III in that. And, you know, I think he's a really great talent. I'm not sure how old he is. I even tried to look up how old he is because there's a couple of scenes in the movie where it kind of strikes you how young he is.
Yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me if he was actually 15 or 16.
Yeah.
In the movie, the character is 15. But he's not like one of these young actors who... they sometimes hire as teenagers and you know, they're like 24, 25, you know, back to that joke about, you know, in 21 Jump Street where the gym teacher says to Channing Tatum, like, when did you go into puberty in grade 3? You know, it sometimes feels like that when you see these, but he has, you know, you can see the youth on his face. He has such great physicality, you know, in that clip he's talking about, oh yeah, when I'm done growing, you know, I'll lift the weights, but I haven't grown in 6 months because he's all gangly and wiry and, I would almost say sickly because it's very strongly implied that he doesn't get a good meal from one day's end to the next.
And I looked up the actor. The actor is 18.
Oh, is he?
Life. Okay. Named Charlie Plummer, and he is no relation to Christopher Plummer.
No.
Even though they're in the same movie together, and you'd wonder.
Yeah.
But he gave a really striking performance. I thought it was an amazing performance. And gangly. And he has this exhaustion throughout, which fits with the character. The character is like on this journey to find roots almost. You know, he's always trying to find family or a home.
Yeah.
And even when he has a quasi home at the start with his father, it's not the best environment. And then he goes from there to the horse track and he's sleeping in Dell's truck at the horse track and then in cheap motels. And he's just trying to find roots. And then, you know, He leaves with the horse and he's walking, sleeping, you know, in the desert and stuff like that. So it's really interesting journey he's on. And it's based on a novel, which I'd really like to read. I thought it was such a good story. But the acting by Charlie
Plummer
as opposed to his character Charlie Thompson. But Charlie Palmer, I thought it was an amazing acting performance. So the future is probably bright for this actor because he really has to carry the film. Like early on, there's a lot of odd characters, right? And he's sort of playing off of that in more of, you know, a low key way. But as it goes on, you see his emotion, and when it's just him on screen and silent moments with the horse, or where he's talking to, Lean on Pete, the name of the horse.
Lean on Pete's the name of the horse. Yeah, yeah.
When he's talking to Pete, it's you know, it's really fascinating. I think he does an incredible job.
Yeah, he does a really good job in these sort of like monologues where he's talking to Pete, like they're having a conversation, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, hard to pull off because how do you make it sound sincere and you know, mm-hmm. and keep in mind that he's talking to a horse, but he, you know, there are these really great monologues where he's talking about, you know. You know, people probably watching this are like, well, why didn't he just like call? Like, maybe doesn't he know people from his old neighborhood in Spokane? And he talks about that, and he talks about how, you know, he would go over to his friend's house, and it would be like a big house, and the family would be there, and there'd be laughter, and you know, there'd be, you know, he saw this as like a model of like the perfect family, mm-hmm. and the movie is very much him in search of that, and he finds it. Sometimes there's the house in the desert or with the two veterans that he comes across, and you know, he has you know, an interaction with them, and for a while it feels very welcoming, but of course it's transitory. He has to get back out on his way into the desert and try and reach his aunt. That's where he's trying to go, and after his father dies from his injuries, as he's trying to reach his aunt in Wyoming, and I don't think you have to be a geography expert to know that walking from Oregon to Wyoming is kind of a hike. We get these, you know, long scenes of just like walking through the desert and talking to Pete. And
and an interesting thing, too, is it must take place in the 90s or something, because there's no cell phones.
No, that's an interesting point, because he does get a smartphone from somebody.
Oh, did he? Oh,
near the end when he's trying to find.
Oh, yeah.
He's trying to call.
That's a weird thing, because he's in the city and he needs to call his aunt.
He's trying to find out where his aunt is, and he's borrowed somebody's smartphone.
Yeah.
But
weird.
I had the same thought, though.
Because he doesn't use Google Maps. He uses a map when he takes the truck.
Right.
It's like. I thought it was in the night. Yeah, until you mentioned that. Now it clicks because the smartphone he borrows at the end. Because it just seems like, you know, back then, if you were stranded or lost, you could truly be stranded or lost. You weren't connected through any devices or anything like that. But I guess he was just so impoverished he didn't have a phone or any connection like that. But
But I mean, that's kind of what the movie speaks to in a way. It's like the social isolation. You know, you live in a small place. Mm-hmm. That's not very interesting. Not very many things to do. You know, what does your life look like if your dad's kind of a bum? You don't have a lot of money or any money. Mm-hmm. You know, and all you do is like sit around and watch, you know, TV. You know, you come to understand like maybe why the horse track has its appeal, because it's something different in a place where there isn't much to do. I'm glad you picked up on like what year is this in the course of the movie, it does take place in modern day, because he does borrow a smartphone eventually. That was interesting. I had that thought through much of the movie too.
He's really isolated because he can't connect. He's trying to get to his aunt and he can't reach her because he's in payphones a lot too, I believe, right? Yeah.
He's because I think it's his mother's sister. Mm-hmm. And because of the father's behavior, he and the aunt got into a fight and lost touch. And there's a scene where he says to his father in the hospital, like, can you give me, I think it's her name's Martha, Aunt Martha's phone number. Mm-hmm. And his dad kind of like brushes him off, you know, even in the midst of dying of sepsis in the hospital. So he's. You know, he has nobody. He really does have nobody. So, which is why he sort of clings on to everybody he meets. And
yeah,
it's And it's kind of haunting in a way. It makes you sort of appreciate the social connections you do have that, you know.
Right. And like how vulnerable you are.
Yeah.
Especially like if you have a single parent in mm-hmm. sort of a dangerous area or something, right? Like mm-hmm. there were a couple scenes where they said, okay, we're going to call family services now, right? Yeah. And he just ran away when he heard that each time. So there are services available, but obviously he has that perception like this isn't good, and he just wants to find his aunt because that's someone he feels really loves and cares about him. And
well, it's losing the last shred of control, right? Mm-hmm. That you know, if your dad's a bum, and you know maybe you have to move because he can't get work one place, you have to move to another place, but you know at least there's consistency and continuity, there's some level of control, mm-hmm. versus ending up somewhere like in child services where you don't know where you might be from 1 month's end to the next. And mm-hmm. so I kind of get that, is that you know the only way he can kind of take control is to run away from that option where he absolutely knows he has no control, mm-hmm. and pursue the one option where he has that one little bit of control where he can take off and try and find his aunt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's, I mean, that's both industrious and bold, but also incredibly sad that, you know, mm-hmm. here's this kid who any number of things could have happened to, mm-hmm. that, you know, just, you know, thirst, hunger, mm-hmm. you know, tripping over a rock in the middle of the desert and breaking his mm-hmm. leg, or you know, who knows? And there's something very Steinbecky about, if I can make that word, Steinbecky, mm-hmm. John's the reference in John Steinbeck, that of just, you know, you've got nothing. You know, what choice do you have but to just keep moving forward? Mm-hmm. And it's all the more powerful because it is a tale of a young person too. Mm-hmm. And you know, any number of things might have happened to him along the way, and that's in the back of your mind the whole time because it's very clear up front. Mm-hmm. This is not, you know, Black Beauty or a feel good movie like that.
Yeah, and what I found really interesting about it is the deliberate pace and how it's mm-hmm. very episodic, mm-hmm. because you have him with his father, mm-hmm. and then that ends, and then it's him with Del and Bonnie at the mm-hmm. horse track. Then that ends, and then it's him with Lean on Pete, the horse.
Yeah.
And then that ends, and then he's homeless, and then he's with these two homeless, really mm-hmm. nefarious characters in their trailer there. And then that ends, and then, you know, he finally finds his aunt. So
finally
it's like, it's, you know, it's so interesting to watch that journey and how the movie just takes its time. It's a little over 2 hours.
Yeah. It didn't feel like 2 hours.
No, yeah.
It felt, I guess maybe because of that episodic structure, because you can sort of, you know, come to the end of a scene and then move on to the next one. I'm not sure Steve Zahn was particularly convincing as a drugged out wacko, but I did find that scene haunting because Charlie is a very passive character. Like, his instinct is to run. Mm-hmm. Even, you know, the scene with the dine and dash where mm-hmm. he, you know, he gets caught and his instinct is to run, like at any opportunity, just run. Mm-hmm. And that's the first time where he kind of doesn't run, where Steve Zahn kind of thrashes him in his mm-hmm. sleep and takes the couple of bucks he made painting a house with, mm-hmm. with Mexican migrant workers. And, you know, he there's the next scene is him like kind of walking around the corner, walking through the neighborhood, mm-hmm. and he finds a tore up car and finds a tire iron in the back. Mm-hmm. And I thought he'd walked, we catch up to him walking, having walked for a while, but no, this is just him walking around the corner. He takes the tire iron, goes back, and beats the Steve Zahn character.
Yeah.
And that was, Lord forgive me, even more haunting to me than watching Lean on Pete gets struck by a car, mm-hmm. because through like an hour and 50 minutes, we've seen this passive character, this like very tender boy, mm-hmm. kind of take every lump that gets to him. And here he's like kind of unleashed. He is now giving the lumps, even though like arguably it was deserved on the part of Zahn.
Yeah.
But you know, that was quite shocking for me. It's like to see this character like finally snap.
Yeah. And, yeah, it's probably been pent up, the rage, but also the fact that Steve Zahn character stole his money, right?
Yeah.
Like, he could really see the value of money. You know, Steve Buscemi, early on gives him what, $10 or something. I'll give you $10 to help me with my truck here. And he's like, yes, you know, finally I'm making some money. So
yeah,
he could really see, and to have somebody just take away that was like his livelihood. No, that's his way. His escape would be to compile some money and have this guy just take it from him.
You're right. There's an appreciation for work, right? Like, he's proud that he's done doing this work, and he's working for Dell, even if it's for, like, for $25 for a day's work.
Right, yeah.
And then Dell remarks later, he's like, yeah, he's a good kid. He knows he works hard, you know.
Yeah.
He's not afraid to get his hands dirty.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's another level of it, too, is that, you know, he has struggled to get this far, and here comes this person who initially came to him as a friend saying, no, 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 you owe me, you are holding out on me.
Yeah, and it shows, like, there's real character to the kid as well. Like,
mm-hmm.
And he talks about, like, the football team he was on at his past high school, and it's just interesting the structure and he had in his past and how that's just gone away on him, and now he dreams of that again. And when he finally gets back with his aunt, he's like, can I be on the football team for this school that I'm going to be going to?
Yeah, and you see early on, he's like unpacking his trophies. Like, so he wasn't just like a participant. He was actually a good athlete and had been rewarded in some way for his athleticism. Mm-hmm. And you see him unpacking them, and he's like so delicate with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are treasures. Probably... really the only things he has that reminds him that he's not just, you know, sort of pinballing through life. And he loses. I think he leaves his pack in the desert after Pete gets killed. And like that's heartbreaking at the end where he wakes up his aunt in the middle of the night and he's like, you know what, I'll just stay here a week and then you can kick me out if you want.
Mm-hmm.
And then he kind of like very slowly... And I love the aunt's reaction. She's like, okay. And because I think she understands that this kid's been through some things. And that scene where he's kind of like saying, like, okay, you know, maybe I can go to school and maybe I can join the football team. You think that would be okay?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and she's very understanding. And she's like, yeah, that'd be great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he just eventually breaks down. And mm-hmm. it's like probably the first time this kid's ever been able to just like break down and mm-hmm. be a kid, because
mm-hmm.
you know how many times has he probably like helped his old man into the trailer, and mm-hmm. you know how many times has he had to cover for him when he was like too hungover to go to work. And you know, he mentions that he says I could call my friends and it's back in Spokane and say like, this is what my life is now, this is what I'm doing, I'm, you know,
right,
leading a horse through the desert, pointing in the direction of Wyoming, but I don't want them to see me like that.
Yeah, he has that sense of pride, right? So he does have like that lifeline back to Spokane, he mentions, right?
Right.
That's interesting, yeah, but he just doesn't want to do it because he doesn't want them to see him like that. And he's in such a physically exhausted and emotionally exhausted state throughout as well.
Yeah.
He doesn't, and when he finally gets to see his aunt in the library, she can tell right away he's been through something, right? He's just walking in and
he's you see the look on his face. He's like, he's not 100% sure that she's his aunt, his aunt, and that he's like made it. Like, is this another test? Like, is this another thing I'm going to have to, like, run from?
Yeah.
Because it's a whole other mission for him to try and find out, because he's calling this bar mm-hmm. and trying to find out where she moved and who she's married to. And, like, he's told that she got married and moved away and she worked at a library. What library? And,
mm-hmm.
and it's just one thing after another in front of this kid. And, of course, it pays off for him. His father tells him all the best women are waitresses.
Right, yeah.
And all the That's waitresses he meets... end up being, you know, the women who help him out. The first, the waitress who kind of forgives him, the dine and dash, and then his aunt has used to be a waitress at this one bar. So that's a little nice turn for the movie to finish up with.
Yeah, that's a great line, and it's great that, you know, and you kind of think once he sees his aunt, everything's going to be okay, which is good given how bleak the movie is up until then.
Yeah.
You know, if they wanted to just put it into the darkest territory, they could have been like the aunt, you know, it doesn't want to see him or something. Or, but it's great that at least there was a little bit of a silver lining at the end after all this trouble this kid's gone through.
And there's a little hint at the end where he's like running around the neighborhood and he kind of stops at one point and looks around, and it's like in the back of his head, even though he looks like he's more fit, he's wearing clean clothes, he's gotten a haircut. Mm-hmm. He's looking around, there's this like shred of paranoia that like, you know, here I am in another place that yeah. I may have to run from.
Just
sometime.
Don't go to the horse track.
Do not go to the horse track.
Stay cross country running. Stay on the football team. Don't go to the horse track.
There's okay. nothing but heartbreak at the racetrack.
Yeah, exactly.
Which seems like a good place to leave it on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was Lean on Pete, and it was playing at the Bookshelf last week. But if you can find it somewhere, I'm sure it'll be on VOD or DVD very soon. And
it's a British director too, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Americana movie by a British director.
Yep. He directed 45 Years, and I think people might be familiar with that. So definitely find it, win it if you can. And you can find more episodes of End Credits on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. Find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show and End Credits Radio on Twitter. And Tim, if you have anything left to plug.
I'll just continue because you cut me off at the start of the show. But my fringe play, The Joy of Sax, which is an absurd comedy. Social media for it, Instagram at Flash and the Deadpan Productions, and then Twitter at Flash and Deadpan, and Facebook Flash and the Deadpan. Check us out there. We're putting up pictures of rehearsals and bios for cast right now, so check it out.
Yeah, I have actually been checking it. I've been following it on Instagram, and I look forward to seeing it.
Thanks a lot, Adam.
Yeah. I might have to splurge for a trip to the Toronto Fringe this year. I've been to Toronto Fringe before. It's not like it's a foreign concept to me, but
no, stop by. We'll we'll find you a seat.
Oh, well, there you go. VIP service. Speaking of VIPs, we are doing election coverage on Open Source's Guelph for the next few weeks. So if you want to hear from the local Ontario election candidates, that's where to go. Wednesdays. Sorry, that's our current time. Thursdays at 5 p.m. on Open Source's Guelph with Scotty Hertz there. And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And daylight savings time for End Credits will be over next week. We'll be back at 2 p.m. on Wednesdays, and we will see you then.